Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up President Doug Tuthill talks with Kelly Smith, founder and CEO of Prenda, an organization creating in-home micro-schools. School reopening is the biggest story of the summer. How can it be done safely? Is it possible? Many families are looking for new, smaller alternatives. And that's where the micro school comes in. Smaller environments of less than a dozen closely aged children blending mastery-based learning with peer collaboration. This model is sweeping across the country as a result of COVID-19. Is it actually the future of public education? That question and more on this episode of Podcast Ed.
So I'm really excited today to have Kelly Smith, who is the founder and CEO of Prenda. Kelly, welcome. You're doing some fantastic stuff, and we're excited to talk to you today.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about big picture. You talk about Prenda as changing the way we think about education. What's that mean? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You could talk about structure, and I'm sure we'll get into a lot of that. I think at the core, there's a fundamental decision to be made in how a human engages with the world. And so this gets meta. I, for example, went through my whole school existence all the way into grad school, thinking that I would look at objectives given to me, hurdles and hoops, and I would navigate those hurdles and hoops. I would play. I had this kind of implicit promise that if I play the rules of the game would spit me out somewhere good. That crashed for me at age 26, 27. I was good at the game, so I ended up at MIT as a grad student. You'd think this is all happy, you know, roses and lollipops and all that, but ended up failing my first test in magnetohydrodynamics. Found out not only did I not know the math and physics that I needed for the class, I didn't even know how to learn, and it was a devastating, almost like a full identity challenge, because here I am thinking I'm this, and finding out that I'm not anywhere near what I thought. And then it got me asking all sorts of questions. So if you kind of like look forward, for me, it was this process of figuring out what does it mean to engage with the world and to learn things and to have this confidence to go out and solve problems and create things and build the life you want and tackle challenges and your own. There's fortunately lots of people talking about these things, and we'll get into it. But at the core, that's what Prenda's trying to do, is extend that hand of invitation, and to do it at a much earlier age. So de-emphasizing some of the structural kind of comparison aspects of school that have become a little bit stressful for a lot of families and parents, and instead going straight to this question of how are you going to be in the world? Can you learn things? Can you figure it out? Can you, accomplish what can you climb the mountain we talk about? Climb the mountain that's there for you. And that's going to look different for every person.
So we're going to get into the micro schools and sure. The innovations that you're promoting. But I'm a little bit curious more about your own journey. Go from MIT engineer to guy promoting micro schools around the country. Just give me a little more detail about how that transition happened.
It's a reasonable question. Absolutely. So I left school. I left with a master's degree. I had thought I was going to be a PhD, you know, research scientist, because that's what, you know, smart people go into academics. That was sort of the assumption. And this whole process to me actually led me to ask some more questions about what do I want to do? What do I find engaging? I realized that I wanted to solve problems. I wanted to be engaged and help people. Today, I was working on nuclear fusion, which someday will be a huge solution to world problems, but not soon, because there's still lots of research that needs to happen before that's live. So I left. I worked in technology jobs. I always found myself kind of right on that intersection of, you know, understanding what the problem is by talking to people and just learning from them, and then solving those problems with usually including some sort of form of technology. And I'd worked for software companies and hardware companies. I ended up selling a small business that I had started, and I moved back to my hometown, and I was spending some time. My oldest son was 8 years old, and I said, you know what, you should learn computer programming. And of course, I still believe every kid should, you know, at least take a look, because it's a great way to practice thinking and just being rational. And instead of the two of us doing it at home, you know, with me as the tutor, I said, let's just do it at the public library, and we'll use this computer lab. We'll open it up for free to the community, and we'll put up posters. There's kind of a low-income neighborhood around where the library is in my city. And so we ended up starting to see these kids come in. I didn't know them. You know, they would show up and participate. Every week we did this for I was there every week for 5 years. I think I added it up. I worked with thousands of kids. And it was interesting because this became inadvertently, I wasn't trying to get into education. It inadvertently became this kind of testing ground for me. I've been watching the problems unfold, and I'm seeing these kids come in with, you know, all kinds of twisted stories in their minds. Like, I'm dumb and I can't do math and I'm bad at school. And a lot of them were getting in trouble. You know, they were having these problems, but I would watch them code. I could see their thinking, could see into their brains. And I knew that it wasn't a question of capability. It wasn't that they're not somehow not smart enough to do this. They're plenty capable. It just, they didn't have kind of a framework to be able to do it. And that hand of invitation that I was talking about, what happened with coding is they would get in there and figure stuff out and create these cool projects and share them with their friends and get real into it and energized. And then the end of Code Club would happen and they're like, oh, I have to go back to school tomorrow. And it got me just asking these questions of, you know, what if school had this energy? And what if this type of learning was available, not just for coding, but for math and science and social studies and all the other subjects? So that was when I started talking to my friends. They quickly said, only crazy people start schools, and please don't do that. But it was already too late, I think. I had the idea. I pulled my son out of school. Six of my friends pulled their kids out of school, sat around my kitchen table the next semester. So full time every day for a whole semester. It was me and seven kids, and we were basically making up this concept of our version of a microschool. And you'll hear people talking about microschools, of course. But I had some exposure by this point. I had started researching and seeing, okay, there's some cool things happening, and kind of knew about them. I didn't know any of the people yet, and I was really an outsider to the education world, which in a way helped, because then I was able to just do whatever felt right and learn from it. I did some real stupid things, and also, you know, there's some things that we landed on that were pretty cool.
So talk to me about your model. You're promoting micro schools. You have a particular model that you're using. Deep dive on what your model looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. So a micro school for us is between 5 and 10 children, typically similarly close in age. So we'll do the Montessori groupings, like K-2, 3-5, 6-8, with flexibility, and we let people kind of switch that up. The kind of core of the experience is a group of kids coming together, learning together. It's facilitated or supported by an adult, and we call this adult a learning guide, just like you'll see in other programs. It's really important that this isn't a teacher. They're not trying to move content from them to kids. They're not trying to kind of overly create. One of the things I'll say is people show up at school and expect education to sort of happen to them. Like, I'm a passive recipient of an education. You'll even hear people talk about like getting or receiving an education. To us, that's not how it is. It's something you do. You're an active participant. You're making this choice. And so to create that structure, we knew we needed really talented, dedicated, caring adults to run these micro schools. We quickly knew that it wasn't the same skill set as what kind of traditionally recognized in education. And so instead, what is a learning guide? And for us, it was somebody who cares deeply in a very real, meaningful way about kids. One of our core values is start with heart. What we mean by that is you have to be able to see these kids as human beings and like honor the kind of the divinity or the infinite value that they just naturally have as human beings, and every human being entitled to that. And you have to see potential in them, right? If you see them as an obstacle, an annoyance, your standard kind of teacher's lounge chatter about all the kids that are giving you pain and suffering, I mean, it's all understandable. Like, I get it. But for us, it's like we're looking for the people who can rise above that and actually see the humans underneath. And that, like, I don't mean to make that sound easy. Like, that's actually really hard to find. But what we found is that they're all over the place. And finding these people and then giving them from there all the tools and equipment that they need to be able to create this environment and have this impact in the lives of young children.
How do you respond to the criticism that, you know, there's a science to good pedagogy, and that ignoring that science is problematic? That for some kids, a teacher who has a good background in cognition and learning, for example, can do a better job helping that child than a really caring adult who lacks that knowledge.
Yeah, I totally agree, actually, with the idea of science and good pedagogy. And I've personally learned quickly over the years of doing this, and our team is now, like, we're filling in those spots. So we're all about using everything that's been figured out and solved. One of the, you know, I talk about start with heart as a core value, but another of our core values is figure it out. And that applies to us. We're trying to, you know, learn and figure out. We don't automatically accept all conventional wisdom. We found, you know, just in life that can be problematic, but we also don't reject it naturally, right? I'm going to start, be curious about it, figure out what works. I think my answer to that person would be to say, you're right that the brain portion of it's important, but we've made a deliberate decision to, like I said, start with heart, right? So Teddy Roosevelt said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And we actually think that's true, right? So you can be the most genius pedagogical master of all time, but if it's clear from your interactions with another human, and by the way, 5-year-olds can figure this out just as well as a 14-year-old, just as well as an adult, right? It's like, how do you see me? It's none of that's going to matter. And so really starting with that, solving for that, and then filling in and supporting. And so we can talk about some of the things we're doing, but remotely monitoring data at a large scale, finding places where we need interventions like special ed in a much more like surgical scientific way, right? Where you can kind of find those needs, those skill sets. I mean, we're building it. It's not fully done yet, but the vision is to be, to support fully the academic pedagogical brain side of this, but really to start with the human interaction of an adult who cares and a kid who feels confident.
So probably in most cases, your story is somewhat similar in the sense of, I'm a parent, I've got a third grader who, you know, I have this need to really sort of homeschool, really. And so I hook up with you, and I want to create sort of a micro school, which is sort of a micro homeschool. And I bring in 8 to 10 other kids, similar grade levels. And now I can sort of build out a sort of robust, so it's sort of a combination of private school, homeschool. Is that fair?
Right in the middle. I mean, I joke that our kind of core demographic, some of them have homeschooled before, but most of them have not. And what they've done instead is they've lied awake at night in bed with their partner talking about it, you know, agonizing over, well, what would that be like? How would that work? They've Googled all the things. They're like participating in some, you know, online forum discussing Facebook, but they still see it as like, well, no, because my daughter wants to be around other kids. That's really important. I don't really want to do all the work of like aggregating all the resources and kind of running the program. And so what we found is really we're finding those people, giving them kind of permission and an avenue. And so it's in a lot of ways, it's accelerating what already is a growing, you know, move into homeschool, but it's giving people the stepping stone that feels a lot more, you know, tangible and possible for them.
Give me some more examples of the kind of things you would provide for me if I wanted to set up a micro school at my home. What kind of support systems would I get? Talk to me about curriculum, standards. I mean, what kind of support systems do you give me as a facilitator in one of these schools?
Yeah, great question. So typically, and it's important to say, that same person lying awake at night is often turns into our guide, but doesn't see herself as a guide at the moment. She's considering homeschool. She looks into Prenda. It's like, oh yeah, this would be better. The first question is always, where can I send my kid? You know, and in Arizona, we've started to get some density. So we've created this map, and you can kind of see where the other micro schools are. And some people just sign my kid up, send them to this other person's house. Usually they know that person already. So it's like, oh, I know so-and-so is already doing this. But sometimes not, right? And the question then is like, okay, what about if there's not something like in my neighborhood? It's nice, it'd be cool if my kid could just ride her scooter over to the micro school in the neighborhood. And so they show up and say, okay, what about this? And what they do is they haven't considered themselves as the possible guide. Right. So it's almost like we have to open that possibility for them. Right. Like, you can do this. Right. Our mission, it's probably a good time to say, our mission at Apprenda is to empower learners. We want these kids to see themselves as learners, capable of tackling challenges, being whatever they want to be. Well, what's been surprising to me about this is that it equally applies to the adults in our models. And so this empowerment of, like, you can do this, and watching that light kind of turn on. And so then the question is, like, I think I can do this. And for all the emotional reasons that we've been talking about, they believe all these things. But now the question is, like, but you know, what do I do? And so the first thing we have to do is, like, really give them, like, a structure. Like, what is it? I think if structurally we were to say immediately, okay, you need to go write lesson plans for every day, and you have, like, 90 minutes of instructional time on these subjects, we would lose them immediately, right? Like, that's not what they went to school for. That's not what they know how to do. Right. So we don't have those things. We have three modes of learning, so I can kind of talk through the structure, sure. And then we can fill in the gaps. Conquer, collaborate, and create. The conquer mode is really about kids tackling academics. So we give them this picture of, there's a mountain before you. You're gonna, like, hike this trail to the top of this mountain. What that means is every day you're gonna have some learning goal. Like, I'm gonna progress from here to here in math, as measured by, you know, formative assessments in Khan Academy, or doing the, you know, going through the personalized lessons in Lexia. I'm gonna move through English. So we use these software tools. The younger kids, it's less software. We've really tried to incorporate, you know, phonics and handwriting and some of the core motor things. But you can basically imagine, like, there's mastery-based, individualized. I'm progressing through, but I'm doing it in an environment surrounded by my peers. So there's this energy, just like what I saw in Code Club. You'd see people doing online tutorials, but they were doing it together, and somehow that made a really big difference. And the guide in that sense is supporting that. So they're walking around, like, how's it going? Did you get your goals? There's a framework in place for kind of reporting to yourself and to the class. Did I get my goals, and how's that process going? It feels very empowering to the kids. It's all built around being able to own this. And then if somebody's stuck, helping them, right? And what we found that's really maybe surprising is that something like 3/4 of the kind of the service calls that the guide gets where a kid is stuck, it actually isn't about content or pedagogy or subject matter expertise. It's about some sort of process thing, right? Like, well, have you clicked the button that says hint, right? and they haven't, because they don't want to, like, they don't want to feel like a loser. It's like, well, why would you feel that way? Like, what's causing you to? So it's really this coaching through all these psychological obstacles, which, you know, a kid sees them as protective measures to not feel the bad feelings of not knowing something. But what we see them as limitations to being a real empowered learner. And so we're really coaching our guides, and we have a whole training program for this and ongoing support to be able to do that type of coaching. And you can see how immediately, even to be able to notice that in a class of, you know, 5, 7, 10 kids, but also then to be able to intervene, that's a privilege in a lot of ways that a traditional classroom would be really hard to pull that off, because you're so busy kind of managing the room and delivering the content. So that's just conquer mode. Collaborate mode is a structured group activity where the kids lead it. We give them the formats, the guides behind the scenes facilitating and supporting it. But kids will, you know, an example is somebody finds this article about, you know, the history of fireworks in China or something, and they say, I really like this article. They give it to everyone else to read. So we'll find it on Newsela or one of these tools. Okay, everyone read this article. Everyone will take the little reading comprehension quiz about it. Come with notes prepared. Like, these are things I thought were interesting. These are some open questions. And then that child that picked the article facilitates a Socratic discussion around this article. So really just getting kids to this level of engagement with the learning and bringing it to life. So that's collaborate mode. We do typically one kind of whole group activity every day. It's, you know, it can be, I've seen it done as quickly as a half hour, 45 minutes, but sometimes they go, you know, hours long, depends on the day. And then finally we have create mode. And this is where project-based learning, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this, but really cool to just see kids choose their project, choose their team, choose their method. We try to give them as many choices as possible. So what the deliverable is going to look like, how are they going to approach the subject? And again, the guide there is supporting that, right? Not telling them, here's what it takes to get an A on this thing. In fact, there's no A or letter grade on this thing at all. It's do a great project. And then the software where you submit your project has this automatic thing that sends it to your fans. We call them your fans. And that would be parents, guardians, family members, anybody that's kind of cheering for you in your education. And all your work goes to them. So you have this very natural desire to care, right? This isn't an artificial thing. It's like, I did this. I'm proud of it. I want you to see it. And kids, you know, they'll show up the first time and sort of phone it in and give sort of a low. And we ask this question, like, I might have borrowed this from Acton, but like, did you do your best work on this? And it's interesting to watch kids sort of reflect on that question. And, right. And at first, like, yeah, great. I'm going to get away with this. They're looking around. And then the second time, like, they're seeing what their friends are doing. There's nobody is evaluating them to say, like, that's not good enough or this needs to be that. And pretty soon they're just like, oh yeah, I get to decide how good of a job I'm going to do. And you know, it can be a gradual individualized story for each kid, but to see them get to where they really are putting their heart into work, it's one of the signs for us that kids are empowered, right? And that's going to look differently for every kid. But there's that really powerful mindset of, I can do this. I'm going to do it the way that I'm proud of and share it proudly with people that care about me.
You know, it sounds like you guys are dealing with one of the classic struggles in education, which is making sure that you tap into kids' internal motivation. Because one of the criticisms of public education historically is that we destroy internal motivation and replace it with external motivation. So you do the work to get the grade, you do the work to get something externally, and then you destroy the internal drive. And we all know that excellence comes from internal motivation.
I would say the core of it, I mean, I found this quote when I just was early on in thinking about education, but the Plutarch quote, I'm sure you've heard of this, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, it's a fire to be kindled. And unfortunately, I think you do have a whole system that says, here is the knowledge that kids need to have at least until April when they take this test, right? So they just start pouring it in. And if you think about the opposite of that, which is trying to kindle a fire, the worst thing you can do is pour a bunch of water in a vessel, right? It's a totally different mental model. And what we're really working with our guides and our whole structure and our core team is very committed to this idea of how do we kindle fires? What does that mean for a kid? And it's it can take patience. It can take a lot of effort. If you've ever, you know, tried to start a fire without matches or lighter fluid or anything, it's this like almost voodoo dance, like you're trying so hard and you're holding it up and breathing in it. And there's all these things. It's hard. It's not easy work, but we believe we're doing the right thing, you know, and a life of being an empowered learner is much, much more meaningful and helpful to someone.
So with COVID and moving us much towards sort of hybrid or blended learning in the fall, some sort of combination of brick and mortar and at home, more and more people are talking about using this as an opportunity to transition to competency-based, mastery-based instruction and learning. It sounds like that you guys are all over that. It sounds very much that this is a competency-based model. Is that true?
Yeah. Very early on, we were asked, because we're working through, you know, various programs, but we'll partner with like a charter school. And we get asked, okay, well, it's time for grades. Like, we need to enter these grades into this, you know, computer system because that's how school works. And I kind of look and scratch my head. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, why would you do that? It doesn't even connect with, because we can see on a granular basis, like, this is mastery of math standards. This is mastery of English standards. Here's my writing, my latest writing sample. You look at that, it's like, this is meaningful. This is where they are. And it's actually also actionable, right? Like, I know I'm at 63% of fourth grade, and by the end of the year, I'd like to be at 100% of fourth grade. So they have this like very empowering, it's this invitation to control it, right? Whereas you get this thing in the mail a couple weeks later, or your teacher talks to your parents in a conference behind closed doors, and it all feels like you're being evaluated and assessed without your agency being considered at all. There's almost like nothing you can do. Right? You can, but you'll hear this all the time with kids, and we've seen both sides, right? You see the A students that are just like, I don't know, I'm an A student, I guess. Like, and there's no incentive to work hard because I'm an A student. And then you have like the C student, and it's like, I'm a C student. Like, again, no incentive. And letter grades are the manifestation of the fixed mindset in modern days. I mean, this is what we, and so it's hard for me to have a lot of understanding of that when you have all this data now possible to know this is what they understand and what they don't understand, and you can give them power to fix what they don't understand. Like, go learn it. You can do this. And I really do believe in kids, and I believe they're capable of that. And with that guidance and scaffolding, they can make that happen.
So you guys would endorse a growth mindset, which is your intelligence isn't fixed. You're not a C human being. That 100%. With hard work and internal motivation and the right environment, you can grow and develop. So that's a different mindset, a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the defense of traditional people, I think that thinking has penetrated, you know, kind of the consciousness of education. Like, people have posters up in their classrooms. I think the problem is structurally, there's still a structural, if you get all Pavlovian on this, like, you're trying to teach your kid, you know, don't touch the, you know, there's this thing, this really important vase, and I don't want you to touch it. And then every time they touch it, you do some sort of like incentive or reward around. You like say one thing, but then you're teaching them the complete wrong thing with the structure. And so, yeah, that's, we're so big on growth mindset that it's like structural elements that we think support a fixed mindset just bother us.
So let's talk about expansion. You're in Arizona. That's where you started. You're getting a larger and larger footprint in Arizona. We obviously would love for you to come to Florida. You know, it's a fairly dynamic choice, education choice environment in Florida. Talk to me about your expansion strategies. I mean, what's that look like? What are your plans? Where are you going to be in a couple years?
Yeah, so I'll go to 20 years from now, and we'll start there and work backwards. But we want to make this as an available, reasonable option for school, right? A Punda micro school available to every kid in the whole United States, if not beyond, right? So the goal is to bring this as a possibility. We don't think everyone's going to immediately sign up. This is not a, you know, a system killer or something like that. But it's an option where it does, when you find parents who want what we want for kids in terms of empowering them as learners and getting them situated for their life, we want that to be available. So how to do that? It was important to us from the very beginning that this is accessible, right? I did not want this to be yet another fancy thing that only rich people can get. And so we've tried actually really hard and spent, you know, significant amounts of our time and energy just trying to navigate programs that are, I think a lot of the programs are well-intentioned. They kind of line up with the same goals that we have of bringing this type of transformational, you know, education to lots of kids. But the programs in terms of the, you know, the way it is to administer, there's a lot of, they're hampered, you know, you guys know this, you're hampered by the statute in here, and there's this opposition or resistance here, and you have to do things this way. And so we've had to really, you know, navigate all of that. So our goal 20 years from now to be everywhere, I think backing up immediately, now today we're in Arizona only. We've started two things. One of them is we started offering kind of a low cost private pay model for anybody. So we had somebody in Ghana sign up for this, you know, do this themselves at home. And there's dedicated parents who are just, they're ready. They believe what we believe. They're like, let's just go and I'll figure out the money. And we've tried to do that at a low cost. So that's available today. We can do that anywhere. It's not the end for me because, again, that automatically excludes a lot of people who, frankly, have already paid for school in formal taxes, right? So now we're saying, okay, how do we find the situations where we can do what we've done in Arizona, which has grown really fast and word of mouth, and it's tuition free because it's through the state funding. So what we've done is kind of made a list of all the states. We've looked at the programs that exist. We knew from, we're just too small to be able to engage politically. So it wasn't like, let's go change this law or change that law. Instead, we've tried to say, what are the places where we can operate under existing structures? We'll work through, you know, charter school. There's some, so virtual charter school is kind of one direction. ESA programs, obviously, we've worked through those. Tax credits, you know, every state's different, but there's places where we really like the tax credit programs. And so, yeah, still in this process of kind of looking at a top, you know, call it, we're looking for three more states to really prove this out and show that this can work. And that's over the next year or so.